I'm Kathleen Dunn on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio for this Tuesday. This should be a fascinating hour. The author of Extreme Medicine is our guest this hour. The subtitle is How Exploration Transformed Medicine in the 20th Century. And Dr. Kevin Fong, the author, says the book is about life, about its fragility, its fractal beauty, and its resilience. It's about a century during which our expectations of life transformed beyond all recognition when we took what was routinely fatal and made it survivable with heart transplants, intensive care, trauma surgery, and the state-of-the-art life support. This exploration of the human body was no less extreme than our forays into the physical world. Dr. Fong has been involved in both worlds. He is an amazing guy. He's the founder of Center for Altitude Space and Extreme Environment Medicine. He has degrees in medicine, astrophysics, and engineering. He's an honorary senior lecturer in physiology at University College London, has specialty training in anesthesia and intensive care medicine, and has worked with NASA. He writes for The Guardian. He's created several documentaries for the BBC. We'll be welcoming phone calls for him. He's joining us from the studios of the BBC in London. Our phone number is 800-486-8655, 800-486-8655. Email is talk@wpr.org, and our Facebook page is The Kathleen Dunn Show. Dr. Kevin Fong, thank you ever so much for being with us. Hi.
Hi, thank you for having me.
You're a man of many talents.
Yeah, or maybe just slightly confused about where my career is supposed to be going.
You don't know yet? Oh, that's okay. You're still young. You have many more places to go, I guess, although I don't know where. Let's start with Mars, if we could. We have a lot of places to go this hour, but I know you're really intensely interested in space, and you know all about zero gravity, and you've been to Houston, and you love this. What do we have to learn about how far our physical bodies will take us? And how do we learn that before we have the possibility of going to Mars?
Well, do you know, Mars is sort of tantalizingly close to being within our grasp, I think. I mean, many people would argue that it is within our grasp. It's just political will and finance that stands in our way. But it, to me, it is fascinating, really, that we sit here today talking about the limits of physical human exploration. And we're talking about Mars, an object that hangs there in space at, 400 or so million miles distance. And when, if you take us back a century, we would have been talking about Scott and his failed attempt to survive the march back from the South Pole. And this is, 100 years apart. So I think that it's interesting to me, really, that Mars sits there within the limits of possibility so quickly after, we only just about managed to conquer the rest of the world. Mm-hmm. In terms of what we need to know is how to protect the human body from extended stays in space. And when you see astronauts deployed in space and they're waving, on the cameras, it all looks like a lot of fun, and it has the feeling, the sense that it's perhaps like a long-haul flight, but just a lot more fun, when in fact, actually, their bodies are enduring, quite massive insults while they're up there. Their bones are wasting, their muscles are wasting, their hearts and system of vessels are deconditioning, their system of balance and hand-eye coordination is being impaired. So these expeditions in space, these forays into the extremes, are the same wherever you go. And that is to say, we know that we can go there and we can survive there, but it's not forever and it's not without penalty. Mm-hmm. So we have to explore really what it is that how the body responds to these very, very long stays in space. And then also the question medicine has to ask is, what do you do if something goes wrong? How do you deliver healthcare in that environment?
Right. Well, how in the world do you? That's an interesting question.
Yeah, well, I mean, that's tricky, because if you think about what happens, if you go and see your family practitioner or the doctor at the doctor's office, almost nothing about that consultation will work the way you want it to in space. From the moment you walk into the room and you sidle up to the patient, you say, you know, what seems to be the problem with you? You know, they're floating, you're floating.
Right.
That's the first problem. And then everything you want to do with them, every piece of equipment that you look at, any part of that equipment that depends upon gravity, isn't going to work in that environment. And, you know, that's some very basic stuff in medicine, everything from the drips that you might run into your arm to hydrate you, to just, you know, knocking the bubbles out of your drugs to stop bubbles getting into your veins when you inject them. You know, you can't do that. I mean, it all depends upon gravity. So even the most basic thing, the most basic medical intervention in space needs to be rethought, reworked, and replanned.
Mm-hmm. Well, you talked about Robert Scott's journey, ill-fated journey to the South Pole, at the beginning of the last century. We learned a great deal from that. I mean, sometimes we have to learn, and the circumstances under which we learn are fairly tragic, as was the case here. But that expedition taught us about hypothermia, didn't it? What else did it teach us?
Well, you know, I think that I opened the book with that story because, you know, it's striking what happens to Scott marching to the south, marching home from the South Pole, and he dies in a tent, freezing to death, about 10 to 12 miles from what would have been his place of shelter and safety, one-ton depot where he would have found food and warmth and light enough to keep him going indefinitely, almost indefinitely, while awaiting rescue. And, you know, I put that out there because it was us trying to meet the challenge of the austerity of the Antarctic environment in the extremes of temperature and hypothermia there, but because it's an excellent example of sort of heroic exploration. And we didn't take direct lessons away from that. That is to say, we didn't take that and study it scientifically and then find all these wonderful marvels for medicine. But for me, at least, at the beginning of the 20th century, it was sort of the beginning of this huge heroic adventure of exploration, which saw us simultaneously look out, you know, across the globe and then out into the endless skies and finally onto the endless frontier of space. But at the same time also, it took us inwards to explore the human body and appreciate its limits, but also its incredible resilience. So I think that the lessons from Scott are really those of exploration, and they tell us about why exploration, whether it's that of the human body or the physical world, is essential for our ongoing survival.
And why is it essential for you as a doctor? Because I know you've done a great deal of exploration in terms of being underwater, going to pretty deep depths, putting yourself in zero gravity, etc. I mean, why do you do that?
Yeah, well, it sounds a little bit like I'm a bit masochistic at times.
That sounds fun, but for some.
It is tremendous fun, and that's not the only reason for doing it. I started out life studying astrophysics at University College London, and I enjoyed that immensely. But the thing for me about astrophysics was that it was, you know, about looking at the extremes of the physical universe. So the oldest, the coldest, the hottest, the heaviest, all these beautiful exotic objects out there in the cosmos. And then using those studies to try and inform everyday physics, you know, the physics of a cup of coffee or whatever. What you could take, if you take a system and you look at it right at the edges of it, you know, its boundary conditions, you can often unmask some of the properties of that system as it is, you know, in everyday life. And when I started to study medicine after I was studying physics, I sort of got this idea that perhaps we might be able to pull off the same trick with the human body, that if you were able to look at the human body and the way it behaved in extremis, whether that extreme was there because of the physical conditions in an exploration environment or whether it was there because of the extremes brought by injury or illness, we might learn something about the human body. And I think that increasingly is the truth that you know, that these adventures into the extremes of the human body have educated us, I think, in physiology, biology, and in medicine.
And your book is a testament to that, indeed, in so many different areas, in terms of the heart, in terms of trauma, intensive care, etc. Let's talk a little bit about some of what you've done as a doctor, and maybe we learn more about trauma care from other instances, from war experiences, or you tell me where. But I was really interested in your response, because there you were to the terrorist bombing in 1999 in Soho, where you were just out of medical school, I understand, or a few months out of medical school, and you were in the middle horrific terrorist bombing, people looking at you and others to do something, right?
Right, and I think maybe that experience partly, I guess, catalyzed my sort of, you know, my interest in the extremes. And so I was about 9 months qualified, you know, out of medical school. And I was on call that night, and all of the pagers went off in the hospital at the same time. It's a really eerie sound. You know, it comes from like this you're used to the sound of your own pager, but you hear the sound of your pager coming from everybody's belt everywhere around the hospital. And they're declaring this major incident. And you know, it was after hours, and there weren't that many of us around, and so the team at the scene asked for a mobile team to go out, and I was one of those people who was sort of manhandled into the back of an ambulance and sent out to the scene. And it was a horrific scene, and to this day, in 15 years since, I think they're perhaps the most severely injured people I've ever seen. And yet we were there in the middle of Soho, you know, a place that's sort of better known for its nightlife and bars and clubs than it is this. And we were there trying to provide the best care that we could. And, you know, it was a terrible day. We did what we could, and the teams that were there brought them to the nearest hospitals that they could. And those people were so terribly injured that I, you know, as a very junior doctor at the time, I just thought that there was no chance that any of them would survive.
Right.
And yet, of the people whom they managed to get to hospital, all but one went on to survive. And you know, that for me was this really stark illustration of, you know, that these are the limits, I think, of human survival in the face of injury. Mm. And you know, there is, you never really know for sure, and that line between what is survivable and not survivable is really genuinely unknown and very grey, and we do well, you know, to be able to probe it and know definitively where our limits lie. And so all of those episodes, the stories of survival I talk about in the book, really for me are that process of exploring the limits of human life.
Right. And Dr. Fong, what had to come before that? What was the most important thing that we learned in terms of breaking a physical environment or going to an extreme or sophisticated medicine? Was it that allowed all those people to survive? Was it what we learned about trauma victims and how to take care of stabilized people, what they needed to do, you as a doctor needed to do when you encountered people like that? Was it as a result of war and the kinds of horrendous injuries that a body would receive? What preceded medically what happened that day?
So that's an excellent question, and you know, it's one that in some ways I was sort of trying to answer to myself, really, in the chapters of the book, was that, you know, how do we create the survival that we take so for granted, really, you know, in modern metropolitan life, certainly, and just modern life in you know, high-income countries, that survival that we take so for granted, you know, that if you're severely injured, you know, God forbid, in an accident or an act of terror, that there is an outside chance that someone will drop out of the sky or drop out of a vehicle and take you into a hospital and give you an outside chance of surviving that. And those things were just totally unsurvivable but for a couple of decades now. And so when you ask yourself how we created that audacious modern survival, it's a difficult answer. We didn't design it. It sort of is these are the accidental fruits of episodes of exploration earlier in the century. And so, when you're asking me what the secret to survival is of those people who were so badly injured, it is intensive care, which in itself comes from the fight against polio in the middle of the 20th century. But it's also trauma medicine, which comes from what we learnt through many ages of war. It is also rapid transport, which we learn from the battlefields of the Napoleonic Wars. But it's other things. It's blood transfusion, it's surgical techniques. But all of these things are themselves the results of different fights of different times. And they weren't designed specifically to create our modern survival. They just came together. They're the sort of the accidental success story of our exploration through history, I think. Mm-hmm.
I was interested in the heart and how, when you think about it, all of the people who have heart disease all over the world right now and how it's treated, it wasn't that long ago that people were just sort of experimenting on the heart, or they just gave up on it, saying, if you had a heart attack, you were gone. People just didn't know what to do. They couldn't go into that inner part of the body. They had no idea.
No, and that was quite striking for me because, we understand surgery as an art that is many, many centuries old. And so it follows that you think, the most important organ, or arguably one of the most important vital organs, the heart, the human heart, must have been operated upon four centuries similarly while we developed our techniques. And yet when you read the history books, until the start of the 20th century, the heart was considered this inviolate hold, something that couldn't be operated upon. It was just seen as being completely different from all the other organs. It was, it was there in front of you. It was dynamic. It moved. And it was quite clearly the engine of life in front of you. And so great authorities at the start of the 20th century, around the same time that Scott and Amundsen were racing to the South Pole, were saying, the territory of the heart, like the territory of Antarctica, is unknown and lethal, and we shouldn't go there. It is some time before we find ourselves emboldened to try and explore that territory, and it doesn't come quickly. The First World War, there are a series of injuries to the heart that come from new weapons and new types of weaponry, and there are some fledgling attempts to operate on the heart there, and one very beautiful account that really struck me, which is why I ended up including it in the book, was by a surgeon, one George Gray Turner, who would later become the president of the Royal College of Surgeons of England, and he found a soldier who'd returned from the Western Front with a bullet in his heart. And he knew that the received wisdom was that he shouldn't operate on this soldier. But he thought, I just can't leave him with this bullet here. And this guy had walked into the field hospital, and he thought, what should I do? So he proceeds and he tries to operate. And in his description, and there's a very beautifully written paper from, I think, 1916, and I think it was in The Lancet, he talks about his way into the heart, the incision he makes in the chest, and how he pares back the ribs and exposes the heart. And he describes how he marvels at how solid it becomes in contraction, and how flaccid it becomes when it's relaxing. These things that we take for granted as knowledge about the heart, he's witnessing and documenting for the first time, really, or amongst the first accounts of this. And he labours for a long time, and eventually, in frustration because he can't find the bullet, he flips the heart over, whereupon it stops, and he returns it to its normal position, massages it back to life, and places it back in that cavity. So he gets out of there unsuccessfully. The patient survives, but he is unsuccessful in his surgery. And it's not until World War II that again we have weapons of war putting shrapnel and bullets into hearts that we finally gain the courage to operate on the heart. And in this case, it was an American surgeon called Dwight Harkin who is in command of a field hospital in the United Kingdom. And he manages to remove 134 separate fragments from the hearts of injured soldiers.
Goodness.
And not a single one of them dies.
Goodness.
And it is that act in the wake of the D-Day invasion the D-Day landings, it's that act that lays the continent of the heart open to exploration in the same way that the continent of Antarctica was laid open to exploration by Amundsen and Scott. And so the parallels between the physical exploration of the world and the biological frontiers of the human body, for me, at least there, were incredibly strong.
And sometimes you have to make mistakes before we start inviting the audience, which we'll do in a moment. I can't remember the doctor's name who interviews on the does surgery, heart surgery, on this very young woman whose heart is damaged by rheumatic fever, I believe, and he's had to go to hospital because he hasn't been doing very well, and, well, you got to figure out what you're doing. It was so new. Then he operates on her, and what happens?
Yes, and so you're recounting the tale of Charles Bailey, a very famous surgeon. And so Harkin comes away from World War II, and he has rivalry all around the world because everyone sees the opportunity in you know, this new territory, the human heart. And Bailey and Harkin have this famous rivalry where they're kind of racing one another to the first successful closed heart surgery on the mitral valve, one of the valves in the heart. And of course, at this time, no one really still believes that it can be done. And so the patients that the physicians are referring to the surgeons are incredibly sick, you know, on the verge of dying anyway. If you do nothing, these people are going to die. So they're nearly dead at the point at which they're given over to these surgeons. And so famously, Bailey's first five patients, the first four die. I think that's right. And he knows, actually, after the first two or three failures, that someone sooner or later is going to stop him doing this altogether. And yet he's possessed by this belief that he can succeed. And so he books the fourth and the fifth operations on the same day in different hospitals in town. And he operates in the morning, has a failed operation, the patient dies on the table, he washes up, gets in his car, drives across town, and does the fifth and first successful operation of that type in history. And so that's a really interesting story for me because, yes, you say we need to make mistakes, but that makes it sound like he was, you know, some psychopath who was experimenting on human beings, when actually the truth is much more complicated than that.
Well, he was trying to save their lives, really.
He was trying to save their lives. Their lives were already under deep threat. And these were people who could barely survive the insult of the anaesthetic itself, let alone the surgery. And so that although that mortality rate sounds horrific, actually, in the context of the time, you know, he was being served up patients who were unlikely to survive any procedure, let alone an operation on the heart.
Yeah.
But you know, moving into the unknown like that has all of the attendant risks of physical physical exploration. And so, you know, but when you look at Bailey and Harkin's story, but it's the organ of the body, the heart, it is one of those tales of racing into the unknown, hoping that survival and good fortune lie in wait. And so, you know, I was very taken by that. And once I'd seen that, I started to see it everywhere in medicine. I started to, you know, recast medicine in my mind, I think, through the later chapters of the book, as a thing of exploration in the same way that the exploration of the world and later the universe had become.
Yeah, the connection is strong. Our guest this hour, who's fascinating, as his book is, Kevin Fong. He's a doctor. His book is Extreme Medicine, How Exploration Transformed Medicine in the 20th Century. And the book is partially informed by what he has been studying. He's just a man who has studied so many different areas so completely, it's remarkable. He's the founder of the Center for Altitude, Space, and Extreme Environment Medicine. His degrees are in medicine, astrophysics, and engineering. He's an honorary senior lecturer in physiology at University College London, specialty training in anesthesia. We have to get to anesthesia. We'll do that in just one moment. He's worked with NASA, and he's a writer, and he's an author. This is his first book. Our phone number is 800-486-8655. I promise you we will be with you in just one moment. Our email is talk@wpr.org, and the Facebook page is The Kathleen Dunn Show. We're also on Twitter at K Dunn Show. This is the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. Dr. Kevin Fong, author of Extreme Medicine, How Exploration Transformed Medicine in the 20th Century, is our guest this hour, and we'll start our phone calls with John in Richland Center. Hi, John.
Hello. I survived a severe traumatic brain injury where I honestly believe that I saw God and my grandfather. My grandfather went to bat for me while I was in a coma in ER, and he said, "What did you do while I crashed at high speed?" And God said, "Let him live." I'm wondering if you ever heard any of those stories before. Thank you.
Thank you for that question. I mean, I personally haven't had patients recount that sort of story to me, although I've heard them secondhand from lots of people, and there's a great, you know, literature about people's near-death experiences. You know, that I guess that's what you're describing here, a near-death experience. And, you know, many very strange things happen when people are very, very critically unwell, and it's you know, it's kind of almost beyond the ability of science to truly explain exactly what's happening there, partly because, you know, what you're describing is what the effects of severe injury and severe illness are upon the human brain, and what's happening in there at those times. And I think if you're talking about continents of exploration, the human mind and consciousness is the last dark continent, really, for medicine and science. And so, you know, I can't offer any answers there, but, you know, I think that's often the way with these very complicated scenarios, that it's very difficult. We don't really have the machinery to describe at this time what was going on, why that happened for you.
Mm-hmm. Susan is next in Madison. Hi, Susan.
Hi. I've heard you speak about how when you get below a certain depth in water,
yes,
that the body will sink instead of bobbing up to the top. And
yes,
also, if you are in a wreck, talked about a helicopter wreck, and being underwater and it's dark out, and you can no longer tell in what direction to swim to save
yeah.
yourself. And
yeah.
my question was, if you can allow yourself to sink, can you determine which way is down, and then from that determine which way is up?
So that's a really great question. And, you know, what you're describing there is something that I've talked about before, which is, well, two different things. First, it's the thing that we call negative buoyancy. So, you know, most of our experience of diving in the water is within a few meters of the surface. And so you have this feeling that your body is an object that wants to float, right? It's, you know, there's many air spaces in it. And so you are naturally buoyant, that you feel that the water wants to throw you out of the water. And yet, that's not true as you descend deeper into the water. After only a handful of meters, you know, maybe 7 to 10 meters, depending on how you're built and what you're wearing, the air spaces in your body become sufficiently compressed that you are more likely to sink than float. And so that's kind of counterintuitive, you know, that actually you might reach a point where you're going to keep on descending and it's going to take an active effort
yes.
to rise up through the water, and also slightly terrifying. Now, why is this important? Well, mostly in swimming pools and at the sea, you wouldn't really go much beyond those depths unless you're a sports diver. But if you're in a helicopter crash, if you're unlucky enough to, and I've done some of the training associated with helicopter crashes, then that's a big deal, because if you're unlucky and it happens at night, and these accidents often do, and the vehicle is below 7 to 10 meters, and you're coming out of the vehicle, you have no cues. You have no cue by buoyancy, because you're negatively buoyant. You're going to sink. Here, you may not have a source of light to tell you where the surface of the water is if it's a moonless night and there's no illumination. And so you have this terrifying thing of, you know, sailors and airmen describing swimming into the inky blackness, not knowing quite which way is up. Now, your question is whether or not actually you can orientate yourself, just understand which way is up without having to rely upon those much more visceral cues. And the answer is yes, you can. People will differ in their abilities to orientate themselves in those situations, because you have to understand, particularly with a helicopter, the first thing it does if it starts sinking is usually it overbalances because it's very top-heavy. So you're going to spin around and you're going to be in your seat upside down. And if you have the presence of mind and the ability, the awareness of your surroundings, to be able to remember that, okay, we've just turned over 180 degrees, so that means that when I go out through that window, actually I need to be swimming in that direction because that's where the surface has got to be, then yes, you probably can try and save yourself in that way. But, you know, I mean, I'm not particularly good at that. So that, I mean, my spatial awareness isn't brilliant. And you know, if someone puts me in a room and spins me around a few times and says, okay, which way's the exit? I'm pretty bad at that. And so I'd probably be pretty bad at this too.
Well, plus you've just been in a darn helicopter crash. You're going to be a little nervous about the whole thing, aren't you?
Yeah, you're going to be literally quite spun up about the
right.
whole thing. And so, you know, it's a tricky thing, and which is why all of the training is centered around you doing some pretty rational things of trying to keep yourself as orientated as you can. So you're meant to put your hand on the exit, your hand on your belt buckle, and sort of try and keep an idea of where your frame of reference is. And that's what the secret of survival is there.
That's fascinating. Thank you so much, Susan, for the call. And how far down do you have to go before you can't realize that down is down and up is up?
Well, I mean, you know, it's not so much how far down you have to go before you lose your orientation. It's really about negative buoyancy. That is that you know, the air spaces in your body get so compressed that you start to sink. And that, depending on how you're built and what you're wearing, can be about seven or 10 meters, around about that. But, you know, a lot of when they've studied these helicopter crashes, a disproportionate number happen at night. And, you know, where everyone should have survived, where people haven't been seriously injured in the crash itself, they still have a horrible number of non-survivors, people who die because they drown in these situations, partly because of this disorientation and descending into the depths.
Mm. All right, let's move to anesthesia. You have special training in anesthesia. You know, I didn't even think about it very much until I started reading your thoughts about anesthesia. And now I'm thinking, this is a really big deal. You better check out who your doctor is in this regard, don't you think?
Well, I'm glad that's how you thought about it, because that's the way it is. But we've always been kind of the Cinderella service in healthcare, I think.
It's very important, though, isn't it? What's the humorous way somebody described the role of an anesthesiologist?
Oh, yeah. Well, you know, I think everyone sort of tends to overlook the anaesthetist, the anaesthesiologist, really. And indeed, there are lots of stereotypes in medicine, and the anaesthesiologist tends to be reasonably shy and retiring, but you know, pretty fiercely bright about the work that they do. The cardiothoracic surgeons tend to be full of lots of self-belief, and I remember someone telling me the story about how a cardiothoracic surgeon was interviewing this anaesthetist for a job with their unit, and sort of in a very pompous fashion sort of leant over the table and said, look, what do you think you can bring to my surgical team? What do you think you can bring to cardiac to this cardiac surgery? And the anaesthetist sort of said, well, that's really easy. You know, it's like flying a plane. I fly the plane and you provide the in-flight entertainment. There's very humorous description. But in a funny way, that's kind of what happens when you're the anaesthetist. You are flying that patient's physiology. They hand over the control of many automatic functions of their body to you temporarily, and you're meant to sit there and keep them flying straight and level while the surgeon gets on with this very important technical task. So it's easy to overlook what the anaesthetist does because, you know, if the anaesthetist is any good, you'll never be aware of, literally never be aware that they were ever there.
Right.
And yet, you know, it's a fiercely complex task. And what we're doing there is we're sitting there trying to manipulate, you know, almost every organ system in your body through drugs and protect it against the insult of surgery and you know, all of that in real time while it's going on. So, you know, it is, that's what's kept me fascinated in the art all this time, and I think that's what attracted me to it.
And Dr. Fong, when did we learn that we could even do such a thing?
Well, the art of anaesthesia in various forms goes back again centuries, but again until the 20th century it was pretty primitive, and I would say that well into the start of the 20th century we're still using sorts of anaesthetic agents that are about as likely to kill you as the surgery is. You know, I mean, that example we talked about earlier of that pioneering effort in cardiac surgery in 1916, around the time of World War I, was performed with an anaesthetic agent composed of alcohol and chloroform and ether. And, you know, these were dangerous agents and very hard to control. And that is part of our ability to advance in surgery. It's very often overlooked. So we tell the story of the pioneers who first operated on the heart, and after which people survived. And we tell that story and as if to suggest that all of history had waited for a few individuals who were gifted enough with a knife and bold enough to dare, when that's not by any means the whole story, or even perhaps the greater part. Because what actually history waited for was the technology to wrap the human body in these sort of layers of protection, amongst them anaesthesia, but also things like antibiotics and blood transfusions, to wrap the human body in these sort of cocoons of protection and protect it against the insults that we offered it in the way of surgery.
Mm-hmm. It's also darn fascinating, isn't it? I can see why people are attracted to it. It's just sort of the ultimate in knowledge, and maybe in extending life and helping people live lives and saving lives and all of that. It's just gripping.
Well, I mean, you know, if you're gonna, this is what we face every day in medicine, in our emergency hospitals, is trying to understand where the limits lie, trying to understand when enough is enough, or when, you know, it is worth persevering, and it's really hard to know what that is, and you are committed as a clinician to trying to work out what those boundaries are, and in doing that, if you're going to know that, you need to try and understand the system as well as you can. And so, yes, it's fascinating, and also I think it's deeply important. I mean, you know, that's where, certainly in my mind, in the writing of the book, I was trying to reconcile those two parts of my life. You know, the one hand that was interested in mountaineers and deep sea divers and astronauts, and in the other part, the bit of me that worked in the ER, on the critical care unit. And in the end, I think, you know, my colleague, a friend of mine at The Guardian, when he read the book, said, you know, Kev, was this just like therapy for you? When he read it, that, you know, that's how he felt about it. He sort of felt it was me trying to sort those things out. And I think it probably was, but I think that's where I arrived with it all, you know, that sense of fascination I have with it all in a sort of detached sense, but also that reconciliation with the fact that exploration is what we do as the human race, and more importantly than that, it's important. It is a large part of the secret of our advanced survival.
Yeah. We're talking with the author of Extreme Medicine, How Exploration Transformed Medicine in the 20th Century. Kevin Fong is joining us from the BBC studios in London. He's an interesting man. He has degrees in medicine, in astrophysics, and in engineering. He has completed special training in anesthesia and intensive care medicine. He has worked with NASA. He's the founder of the Center for Altitude, Space, and Extreme Environment Medicine. He's done several documentaries for the BBC, writes for The Guardian, has a regular column in Times Higher Education magazine. And this is his first book that we're talking about this hour of the show. Our phone number is 800-486-8655, 800-486-8655. Email is talk@wpr.org. Our Facebook page is The Kathleen Dunn Show. And we're also on Twitter, and that's @KDunnShow. How did intensive care get born? We will talk about that. I want to go back to the astronauts for a moment when he talked about what happens to the body when you're in zero gravity and how tough it is on the body. I want to ask him more about resilience and sickness that astronauts feel as well. And NASA designing a space ambulance in the event of an emergency at the International Space Station. What's up with that? So, More phone calls momentarily. This is the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. Kevin Fong is with us this hour. His book is Extreme Medicine, How Exploration Transformed Medicine in the 20th Century. And our next caller is Ted in Chippewa Falls. Hi, Ted.
Hello, and thanks for taking my call. My question has to do with the use of induced coma. Were they induced a coma in a patient? Would that be... could that be used? Is that similar to something like hibernation, and could they use it in space?
So the term induced coma is really this catch-all term that we use in the media to talk about what is essentially sedation or anesthesia for patients who are in intensive care units and, you know, when it's used in the press, it's usually talking about someone who's had a very big brain injury, head injury. We do that, you know, it sounds very dramatic when you say an induced coma, and I guess that is technically correct. You know, you are rendering this patient artificially unconscious with drugs, but it is materially really no different from the anesthetic that you might have for you know, to have your wisdom teeth taken out or you know, to have an appendicitis, to have your appendix removed. So when people say induced coma, they usually mean, well, we've given them sedation, stroke, anesthesia in the context of the intensive care unit to help the patient through that situation, sometimes to try and reduce the metabolic demands of the body, the energy demands of the body and the brain, and to try and reduce the chances of its further injury. Now, your question was that, you know, is this akin to hibernation, and could we use it, you know, in long duration space travel? So it's not really usefully akin to hibernation in the sense that it doesn't sufficiently reduce your metabolic rate to sort of allow you to extend your period of life more so than if you were just sleeping. But then there's the question whether, you know, hibernation per se itself might be useful for long-duration space travel. And it's difficult to see at the moment. There is some interesting work done with hydrogen sulfide that seems to provoke these sort of hibernating responses in some mammals and some parts of our cellular architecture. But, you know, we're quite a long way away from that. And so when people ask me about whether hibernation is a solution for long-duration space travel, you know, I'm less keen to say, well, it's impossible, but it's certainly one of those technologies that is much further away on the horizon than stuff that, you know, might be more useful to facilitate long-duration space travel. So things like artificial gravity, for example, might be more helpful. Regenerative life support, so life support systems which can regenerate themselves. These sorts of things may be more useful, certainly in the near term. Those are the technologies that I think we might realize sooner in this century.
I think some of us were just interested in that hibernation as a solution for the kind of winter that we've had this year, Dr. Fong. Maybe that's the answer. Let's just hibernate.
Yeah, well, I think the polar bears certainly have a good idea.
Yes, I think they do. I want to talk about, because these are fairly dramatic stories, and for people who have been burn victims, I understand that it's just the most painful kind of thing to have happen to you. And you spend some time in the book talking about the human skin. Let me just ask you a question about skin. It always seems to me that our skin is kind of fragile. You know, why were we made so that we've got this skin all over us instead of something that's a wee bit tougher?
Well, you know, I mean, there are always trades. You know, we're a fairly well-designed system, and we are the result of, you know, 3.5 odd billion years of evolution of life, and so there are always trades, and so the apparent fragility of skin is traded against the needs to be able to sense our surroundings. You know, we take our skin for granted. We you know, it's, you know, that we sort of, I guess, we think of it as this sort of biological raincoat that stops us, you know, that's kind of this covering that stops our organs sloshing around in an unsightly way. But, you know, it's a really active organ, and it is an organ, and it's the organ with the largest surface area, and it's there to help us sense the world around us. It's there to keep moisture out but allow the rest of the body to breathe. You know, it forms a vapor barrier. And it has an immune function, and it stops, you know, and again, I mean, you say it's fragile, but actually it performs this amazing, amazing line, and it's our first line of defense against sort of the bacterial hordes that mass on our skin that are trying to get in. So, you know, I know it can superficially look fragile because, you know, you're there with a piece of paper and you get yourself a paper cut.
Right.
And you think, well, surely
right.
someone would have thought of a better system than that. But actually, you know, you're trading that against its ability to sense the world around it. You know, the information you gather through your skin is all important. And its breathability, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. And also, it is pretty tough. You know, when you look at what it has to deal with, it is the system in the body with amongst the highest turnover of cells. You know, they've got these sort of cells marching forwards and forwards, onwards into destruction. So, you know, it is the way it is because it serves a purpose, and that purpose is more than just a simple barrier.
Mm. And when did we make, what was our medical breakthrough in terms of treating burn victims, in terms of plastic surgery? It, some of what's been done recently is absolutely incredible.
Yeah, well, you know, this is, again, a technique that comes to maturity in the last century, that there were various techniques described across history of moving parts of healthy skin to areas of injury to cover it. And those techniques go back, you know, hundreds of years. But when, in the 20th century, we started to engage in this sort of mechanized warfare, we started injuring ourselves in some pretty new and terrible ways. And so some of the first well-documented episodes of the 20th century came in World War I and the Battle of Jutland, so aboard ships with sailors being very badly burnt. And some reasonably primitive attempts were made by a surgeon called Harold Gillies to cover injured areas of skin with healthy skin. But it wasn't really until World War II when we invent air combat and we place young men at the controls of vehicles that are made basically of wood and covered in linen and filled with high-octane fuel. And, you know, we have them shooting flaming ammunition at one another. And that produces disfigurement through burn injury on a scale unparalleled in any period of history before. And faced with these men who would get out of these cockpits burnt beyond recognition, who would parachute down over their own countries, because you remember that the Battle of Britain, these early air war, this air combat was fought over the southern counties of England. You know, they're in their own country and burnt beyond recognition. And what do you do with them? What do you do with these guys? You don't have the medicine that you need to do what needs to be done, which is to reconstruct them and their appearances. And so, you know, you consider, do you just institutionalize them away from society to protect them from society and society yes. from them? Or do you try? Do you try for them? And that's indeed what people decided to do. And a surgeon, very gifted surgeon called Archie Mackindo, and his equally gifted and impressive surgical team at the Queen Victoria Hospital in East Grinstead decided that they would try. And what they did was they moved large flaps of skin from one part of the body to the other by using this very clever technique where they would open a flap of skin out in a distal part of the body, so the leg or perhaps the abdomen, and they would plug that flap so it would still be attached. They'd cut it on three sides and open it like the cover of a book, tuck it into the arm, and wait several weeks for it to grow into place, and then sever it from its original point of contact. Yeah. And then you had a flap of skin that could move on an arm. Now, that sounds very macabre, but it was the secret to moving large patches of skin from one place in the body to the other without them dying. And so in the ages before we had microsurgery, before we could move the skin with its own blood supply, that was the only way to do it. And this, forged in the fires of the Battle of Britain, this was the birth, really, of what we understand by modern reconstructive surgery. And so when we think of plastic surgery today, you know, you think of this sort of slightly prurient description of, you know, Hollywood stars refusing to grow old gracefully, when actually the origins of that art couldn't have been more noble or important.
Yeah, absolutely. So are you going to go to Mars?
That's a conversation I'd probably have to have with my wife first of all, I think.
She can go too.
I don't think she'd come for all sorts of reasons. It's a long journey, you know, with conventional technology now. The outward journey from Earth to Mars would take about 6 to 9 months. And then you've got a choice on surface of something like about a month. And if you don't take the opportunity to come home after a month, you're probably another year and a half before you come. You know, there's only two windows of opportunity, really. And then it's another 6 to 9 months back. So you're talking about a mission that is either the best part of a year and a half or nearly 3 years in length. So I don't know. If someone offers me a ticket, I'll think about it very hard, I think
you would be the kind of guy who would think about it. Well, this was fascinating. Thank you so much, Dr. Fong, for being with us. I'm interested to keep in touch with you and see what's next.
Well, thank you so much for having me on. It's been great fun.
Our guest, Dr. Kevin Fong. His book is Extreme Medicine, How Exploration Transformed Medicine in the 20th Century. He's an amazing guy. How does anybody have enough time in life to get a degree in medicine, astrophysics, engineering, honorary senior lecturer in physiology, special training in anesthesia and intensive care medicine? He's worked with NASA. He's a writer. He writes books. Oh, my. It's a couple lifetimes all put together in one. We thank him so much for being with us. Thanks to Marika Zuval for producing this hour, to KP Whaley for on-air production in our studios in downtown Milwaukee. Tomorrow we will be talking at this time about activism and asking whether or not it carries over from one generation to the next. And we'll talk about felons voting the first hour of our show tomorrow.